everyone to Art of Advisory. My name is Hector Garcia, and I'm with my co-host and colleague, Kirk Bowman. Hey, Kirk, how are you?
I'm good, Hector. How's your panic day going?
It's a tough day to do a live session, but I think it's always good, important to make time for things that you're passionate about and think that fulfill you. So I think it is a wise choice for me to do this, even in the last day of tax season. So today's episode is called Learning from Colleagues or Learning from Our Peers. And Kirk and I have something in common, is that we have taught together in different sessions at different conferences. One of them is called Scaling New Heights, which is in a different city every year, and is a very QuickBooks-centric conference that also covers sort of miscellaneous accounting and accounting industry-related topics, and also QuickBooks Connect. So last year in Orlando, we both taught at Scaling New Heights. And then the following conference, which was in November, QuickBooks Connect, we both taught at there, and then we're back both teaching at Scaling New Heights this year. So Kirk, you're not an accounting professional and you're just getting into teaching Scaling New Heights. Can you give us a Reader's Digest version of your perception of Scaling New Heights when you went and taught last year?
Oh my goodness. Bookkeepers are a group that don't get out much. When they cut loose and party, my goodness, look out. No, seriously, they're a fun group. I really enjoyed it. It was my first exposure, as you mentioned, to the audience at Scaling New Heights, and I really enjoyed it. Met several people that I have known online for multiple years, and also made some new friends. My impression was the conference is well run. I was impressed with the aspects, kind of the administration logistics that Joe Woodard's organization put on. I didn't really go to many other sessions. I really, first of all, I was a day late because here's some advice. Unfortunately, I won't run into this year, but last year it was earlier in June. And so apparently it was the very same week that school let out. And apparently everybody in Texas was at the airport. I was on a 6 a.m. flight. I showed up an hour early to go through security. I did not make it through security because everybody and their dog was trying to get to Orlando to go to Disney the week after school let out. So fortunately, it's later in June this year. So anyway, I got there a day late because I missed my flight. But the good news is that I really enjoyed it. I, of course, did my session and got to attend one of yours. Actually did two sessions. I forgot the second one was a panel session. Was impressed with you think about bookkeepers and accounting, you tend to think of pocket protector nerds, and that's really not the group, right? These are the people who are leading. These are the people who are willing to invest in personal development, professional development. They want to know what they need to do to be relevant this year and next year. And I really, really enjoyed it. So it was a great conference for me, and I'm looking forward to your sessions this year. What sessions are you doing? I know you're doing two. Is that right?
Right. So I'm teaching a session which is a modification of something I already taught or I've been teaching, which is called Creating Educational Videos. So in the past, I have taught in the last two conferences, I have taught sort of video editing and video creation as a marketing tool. And we're evolving a little bit into not just the marketing aspect of video making, but the educational video, sort of the intent, right? So when you create these videos, they're going to be around the intent of educating, not necessarily commercializing, but deep inside, educating and marketing actually go hand in hand, and I think we should deep dive into that. And in the other session I'm teaching is actually a double session. It's 200 minutes. So the way they do it in these conferences are because most attendees are accountants, and accountants need their continuing education credits. The sessions are broken into 50-minute segments. So they have the short 1 hour. For only accountants translate 50 minutes into 1 hour. That's a whole other conversation. But 50 minutes means 1 hour, and 100 minutes means 2 hours. So there's either a short session or a long session. And my second class is advanced inventory. And that one's actually so comprehensive that that one's going to span to two double sessions. So that's going to be 200 minutes, or the equivalent of four educational hours. What about you, Kirk? What are you teaching?
So basically what you're saying is you've gotten worse at teaching the inventory subject, and so they had to double the length of the session. Hopefully you can make it through it. All right.
I'm charging by the hour.
Oh, God. Nice comeback. So I did, you know, one full session last year and one panel session. This year I'm doing three sessions all around, you know, the broad topic of value pricing. And so two of them are brand new sessions. In other words, I've never approached the material from this angle, so I'm really excited. The first session is called, I don't remember the exact title, but my title was Your First Year of Value Pricing. So this session is designed for somebody who has made the decision to implement the business model of value pricing. Most likely, they are currently in some form of hourly billing, and they have heard me, you, some of our other VeriSage colleagues talk about the subject, and they're like, okay, I'm ready to dive in. I've drank the Kool-Aid. I'm ready, you know, not to just talk about it, but I'm ready to do it. I want to put action behind it. So what does that first year look like? A quick summary is that you're going to have to operate in two business models for the first year, because I think it takes about a year to transition, between a year to 2 years. So it's not a 3 month and you're done type of process. It's a journey. And in my business, in my software business, it took us 13 months. Now, I was very intentional about saying we're going to do this in a year, and it actually took us one extra month. So as far as I'm concerned, that's close enough that we hit the mark that we set. What does that year look like? How do you operate in two business models? How do you continue to operate your business, make it, keep it financially viable while you make that business transition? How do you change business models without turning over the apple cart? How do you do that? What does your first year look like? What are the things you need to plan for? What are the type of tools and resources that you need? What are some big questions and challenges you're going to encounter? And we're going to dive into that. So that's the first session. Then second session is really part two. It's your next year of value pricing. Now, I didn't call it your second year because it's designed really for anybody who has been implementing value pricing in your business for at least a year. Once you get past that year mark, you've either completely transitioned your business or significantly transitioned it. So your thinking changes. It's no longer, okay, how do I do this? It's really, okay, after a year, we have done this enough that we feel confident this is how we want to keep doing business moving forward. So now that we've made that transition significantly, over 50% of the business is now operating in the new business model. Now what does it look like moving forward? Now how do we kind of get out of this duality of trying to do things the old way and the new way? The new way is now the standard. We're doing that business model with the majority of our customers. How do we look forward? And what does that look like? What does professional development look like? What does it look like interacting with colleagues, interacting with customers, etc.? Because one of the things you will encounter very quickly, once you adopt this business model, you quickly move from the majority to the minority. In other words, you're going to be showing up at conferences just like we do, and all of a sudden, you're going to be the weird one. You're going to be the one who's doing it, you know, the new way, so to speak. And so we want to talk about what's it look like from that perspective. So the first year of value pricing, the next year of value pricing.
You mind if we unpack that a little? If I try to unpack
Yeah, go right ahead.
Okay. So the first concept that I want to make sure the audience that's listening is that if you were to start a professional services business from zero, so whether it's accounting, bookkeeping, law, consulting, IT work, implementation, that sort of thing. It would likely to behoove you to maximize your earning potential by doing the activities that allows you to extract from your customer pre-engagement what exactly is it that they want ultimately, so you can design a service around what they want and what they need and completely wow the customer while earning the most that the customer is willing to pay, as long as you give them the value or above the value that they want. That's sort of in layman terms what the value pricing model is. I mean, there's a lot of other moving parts to that. And we talked early, we had a session on the value conversation, and we discussed some techniques around what questions to ask and how to discover what the client wants. And in the heart of it, it's all salesmanship, really. I mean, it's split into two, I would say. First is your salesmanship. Like, you have to understand how to intake clients in as a good salesman, but not because you're pushing something, because you're understanding what they want and you're doing the function, which is selling the client what they want and what they need. So it's the salesmanship skills, which a lot has to do with how you speak to people, how you discover their needs, and obviously how you deliver the product that you're selling. And then the other piece, it's what you were talking about, is the business model, is how you design your practice around the fact that you don't charge by the hour. Design your practice around the fact that you market yourself as a value-added service provider. How do you design your practice around, okay, I'm going to hire employees, I'm going to bring in contractors. You know, they may charge me differently than how I charge my customers. How do I translate, how I get paid from my customer versus how I pay my employees and contractors? So that's a big challenge that people have when they're already in business, when they already have a brand and a business model and an infrastructure and a number of customers. So I think what you're alluding to this first year is not for someone starting from scratch. It's from someone having to sort of unlearn everything they learned and shake things up and transform while not somehow destroying what they have created. Is that correct?
Yes, exactly. Now, that doesn't mean we exclude somebody who might be starting from scratch. I mean, if you have the blessing of being able to start a business from scratch with value pricing, you're still going to encounter some of the challenges. You're still going to need the same skills. You're going to need to build those skills. Really, the only thing that's different is you won't have to operate in two business models at once. So while you may not be having to face that challenge, you're still going to encounter customers who come to you with that hourly mindset. And so you're still going to have to address that. So while maybe not all the content will be applicable to somebody who's starting out brand new, I still think it's worth going, because you're still going to encounter a lot of the same issues with customers and you're still going to need the same skills. So I think your summary is valid. And, you bring up, I'm going to come back to this episode and take some notes. Your suggestion about how do you operate with employees or subcontractors, those are all things I've done. And there's different challenges depending on how you're set up and what type of business model do you use with those individuals, right? Are they on salary? Are they on hourly? Do they give you fixed prices? How do you do that? So we're going to talk about not only the external workings of the business with the customer, but also the internal workings of the business during that first year.
Okay. So once you destroy and reconstruct and re-engineer and are fully bought into the process and you're done with that first year. And I think that year, when you say 1 year, you're not saying it must be a year, or it's limited to a year, or everybody's, first journey into it takes the same. I mean, you're using a year because I think that as accountants, as business owners, we tend to use that year as a way to benchmark and measure and New Year's resolution and transformation and all that stuff. Like I obviously 365 days is not the exact time that it will take anyone to go through that. But I think I like when you create a timeline around it, because I assume that you're going to say that you're going to give us the capacity to sort of schedule our progress and track our progress. So after we're done with that year and we schedule our progress and track our progress, what is that? Can you give us a couple of interesting things about that second year? Why is that second, third, or whatever that's like. Why is that so much different than the first one?
Well, probably the biggest difference is the first year you're scared because you're taking a risk. And by the way, if you're not scared, then you're probably not taking a risk. Peter Block has taught us from multiple books that where profit comes from is by taking risk. Okay. In fact, the word entrepreneur comes from a French word that means undertaker. And what we do as entrepreneurs is undertake risk. So if you're not a little bit scared, if you don't feel any fear, if you're totally comfortable, then you're probably not taking enough risk. You're probably not going to get enough reward as a result. But I would say that's the biggest difference. I find that during the first year, you build confidence. So the second year, it doesn't feel as risky. And so part of what we're going to talk about is how do you continue to take risks, not unreasonable risks, but how do you continue to challenge yourself? How do you continue to stretch and to grow? It's not enough simply to make the switch, but then you have to constantly be trying to innovate, constantly be trying to push the boundaries, to offer something new. How do you do that? How do you constantly innovate? That sounds almost like a cliche, but that's a lot of what that second year, and to speak to your question about the time period, yes, it's not necessarily a year. It might be 18 months or 24 months. Yes, I use the term year primarily for two reasons. One, it's the goal that I set to start with. And two, year is a reasonable time period, I think. If I were to say 6 months, I think I'm putting something out there that's really not doable for most people. I think a year to 2 years is the time to transition, and then after that. And that's why the second session is not called your second year, it's called your next year.
That's perfect. So if I let me ask you some questions about the insights around that. So what you're saying is the first year is scary and should be scary because you are, quote unquote, taking a big risk by transforming your business model. And the risk is that the fear that it may not work, or the fear that you will lose your current clients, or the fear that you do it wrong and somehow become unprofitable and lose money. I assume those are the pillars of fear.
Yes.
The other fear that everyone should have in any business, in my opinion, is the fear that somebody with more capital, younger, more staff, more technology can undertake and destroy what you thought was pretty safe. And that's the fear that the tax industry needed to have to out-innovate Uber. That's the fear that the hotel industry should have had in order to out-innovate Airbnb. And whatever the next wave is going to be, the next, you know, sharing economy element, whether sharing economy or some other sort of innovation, I think that when we get too comfortable, and it's usually because we're profitable. That's an interesting piece. Most people, when they're not profitable, they're not comfortable. So I think anyone that's not making a whole bunch of money in their practice would be more resistant towards value pricing because it's already working, right? But if you're not making money, if you're failing, or if you're not being profitable, there's less risk, I guess, because you have less to lose. However, I think that that next year that you're talking about is actually even more important, because that is what's supposed to make us uncomfortable about saying, oh, okay, so I'm value pricing now, so I made it. Well, not really, because, you know, as you teach more and more, and our colleagues get better and better at pricing and adding value, you will no longer be, as you said, the odd one out and the minority. Like you now, once this becomes the norm, then you're not going to get a new fresh factor anymore. So what a second year looks like is this continuous journey to innovate. I guess either your service offering, right? Your service offering, or how you add value to your clients. What exactly do we need to be innovating on? Like, we innovated on pricing. Okay, what's the next? What are we supposed to be innovating on that second year?
Well, obviously, you're correct. A lot of what you're doing that first year is around the broad topic of pricing, but pricing works its way into the business in a variety of ways. Probably the thing that we're actually innovating most during the first year and will continue to innovate into the next year and on is your mindset, because it's ultimately your mindset is your biggest challenge that you're going to have to tackle when you're switching business models. And so we'll spend a lot during that first session talking about mindset and how do you change a mindset while you're still having to operate in the old mindset. So not only did I describe it as operating in two business models, but it's literally operating with two mindsets or leading with one mindset and retiring another. So we'll continue to innovate in that mindset. For example, I recently had lunch with my colleague Ed Kless from Verisage, and I'm fortunate that Ed and I live close together, and every time we have lunch, I come away with at least one new idea, and I actually came away with a couple from our recent lunch, and I'm actually going to save those and share them during the next year session. Number one, because I want to show some examples of how you continue to innovate. But number two, also, I want to show that even after you've been doing this for 5 or 10 years, you continue to innovate. And two people like Ed and I, who not only practice this business model, but teach this business model, we continue to innovate. And how do we innovate? Well, a lot of it is rubbing shoulders with other people who are continuing to be challenged. That's why every 2 years, all the fellows of Verisage gather somewhere in the world. We did it here in Dallas last year in November. So that's part of what we're going to be talking about. And it really comes from a mindset. I mean, it's so easy with not only hourly billing, but even value pricing to think, okay, I've got it. I follow these steps. I follow this formula, and I don't have to, you know, continually try to think about how to do things new. But we're going to plug right into the theme of scaling new heights. The theme of scaling new heights is the rise of the machines. It's this theme taken from the Terminator movies where, you know, the intelligent machines, artificial intelligence, are going to take over because they have advanced. Technology's gotten so far that they can do things that normally humans can do. Now, we're not at that point, but I think there's some fear around that of, you know, technologies replacing what our friend Joe would call the transactional work, right? And so we've got to become more consultative, more advisory in what we're offering our customers. And of course, that's what this show is all about, is helping people in accounting and bookkeeping to become advisors. And so really all three sessions that I'm doing are around the soft skills that you need to make that transition. How do you not, because with technology is going to change. You know, they say two things are inevitable, death and taxes. I would say three things are inevitable, death, taxes, and technology. Technology is just advancing at a very fast rate, and you either get on board or you get run over. And getting on board is changing your business model in a way that you're still relevant to your customers, even if technology is forcing you to change how you do business or the types of services you offer. I mean, you look at the big box retail stores. Look how much they have been impacted by Amazon. It's interesting that Amazon now is opening brick and mortar locations. They're now making the transition. Not only have they killed the brick and mortar, traditional brick and mortar business through their online advances, but now they're actually supplanting the industry that they, quote, killed or had a significant impact on. And so we're going to be talking about those things, particularly in the idea of technology.
Right. So sometimes you have to destroy and pave way with a clean, open canvas, right? Blank canvas before you reinvent. And Amazon may possibly be doing this. Amazon may have killed retail, but they also, with that destruction, they may bring the brand new face of retail. They may merge, you know, e-commerce and retail, because, you know, I don't think that teletransportation will ever exist. And I think that Amazon may do a great job at some point in the near future with, you know, drop shipping things with drones. And we may get to a point where, you know, we call Amazon and within the hour we have a box dropping from the sky with a little parachute. It's not crazy to think about that. I mean, actually, I don't think at all. I think it's actually very feasible. But there's something about, tact, you know, touch is one of our senses. So there's something about going somewhere and experiencing it before you buy it. And it's funny, I used to work for Best Buy. So I used to have a lot of friends that work there. And they tell me that the Best Buy is now known as Amazon's showroom. So people go play with the camera or whatever, and then they go to Amazon and they buy it, which is, you know, it's pretty indicative of you know, how innovation works nowadays. But one of the things that you were mentioning about innovating a mindset, you know, innovation happens inside your head first before it happens outside your head. So that's actually an incredibly important insight, because it is very difficult for you to innovate until you get your head set up to destroy the status quo and reinvent it from scratch. That's the only way to innovate. And then innovation happens on the other side. It happens on the customer's mind. If your customer thinks it's new and novel, then you innovate it. If the customer is not attracted to it and it's not useful to them, then maybe it's innovative to you, but if nobody ever buys it, it's not. So there's two minds that need to be changed in order to innovate. Yours first, in order to come up with the idea or reinvent the idea. And sometimes it takes, it's just a little bit of insight that I heard from one of the trainers or one of the keynote speakers at QuickBooks Connect like 3 or 4 years ago, where they had this gentleman that was selling, I think he was selling hair products only for African Americans or skin products only for African American. And he was asking his friends and family about his ideas. And all his friends and family told him that was a great idea. All his family told him it was a great idea. All his friends and colleagues and told him it was a bad idea. And he was tackling with, you know, do I hear my family that says it's a good idea, or do I hear my friends that it says it's a bad idea? And he said something clicked in his mind after a year of researching, where when he heard so many no's, and one time he was so frustrated that he told a venture capitalist, wow, I can't believe that so many people say no to this. And the venture capitalist says, well, how many people have you asked? And he said, at least 200 people. And he said, they all said no. He says, yes, you know what? I think you may have something. And I was listening to that and watching that and go, wait a minute. I think he's absolutely right. I think that the more yeses you get, it's indicative that somebody already thought of it, or is so close to what already exists that it doesn't make people uncomfortable. Whereas when someone said, hey, I have an idea, you get on somebody's car that you text via your phone that you never met before, and you pay them less than a taxi, and they will get you somewhere faster than and safer than a taxi can. I think once 100,000 people said, no, that's a horrible idea. That's when the Uber guy said, you know what? Then I got something here. So I think there's something interesting about hearing no's so often that makes you think, you know what? If everybody's so against it, that means that there's an opportunity to change it and transform it. So I thought that was interesting, that the way you were talking about the whole mindset thing and innovation. So the other thing I wanted to ask you, Kirk, give us a quick preview of what it's like to deal with folks that are sort of in resistance of this idea of transforming to value pricing. And I'm gonna quote someone that just in our chat asked us this question live, and her name is Kathy. And Kathy, I'm not saying that you're being resistant, but I think your question is actually a perfect question, because it's the type of things that I hear, or I've heard when I hear Kirk speak, or Ron Baker speak, or Mark Wickersham, or all the folks that speak about value pricing in our conferences. Her question is, how do you do monthly pricing when hours fluctuate? And that's the key word there, hours fluctuate during the month. Some of the hours can vary. It could be 5 hours, it could be 10 hours, it could be 15 hours. How am I supposed to value price this when there's so much uncertainty around how long the work will take me? So Kirk, if somebody were to ask you in the middle of the first session, the first year, what would be your answer to that?
So my answer would simply be, you do it a couple of ways. Number one, you price it high enough so that during the peak months, you're happy with what you're getting paid for the value you're creating. The second way is you find new ways to create value for the customer, ways that provide value that they want and that actually does bring more to them than they could have without you, but actually it requires less energy from you. And by the way, notice I said the word energy, not effort, because I don't want to get caught up in how many hours it is. We're actually looking for not only ways to create extraordinary value, but then how can we deliver that value with the least energy necessary from us? Because that's where we can create leverage. If the way you come up with your monthly price is simply you look at the years in aggregate and divide by 12, then you're simply just going to be taking that annual price and increasing it because you should be providing more value. So that's my short answer. I'm sure there's probably some additional follow-up questions to that, but it's through your pricing and also through how you deliver value.
I do have a follow-up answer to that, Kirk. And this is from someone that actually does monthly bookkeeping for a living. The name of my company is Quick Bookkeeping. So we're supposed to do the bookkeeping and do it quickly. That's the name, that's the theme of our business. And we tackle this issue all the time. And Kathy, I got to tell you, I asked the same question for 5 years on my journey to value pricing. And Kirk said it takes 1 year. It took me 5 years. And I think the more you think you know, it's the worst, which was my case. I thought I knew a lot. So it took me longer to unlearn everything that I was blocking my mind to do. But the answer, Kathy, in my opinion, is I believe that your question is framed for failure. Okay. When you frame your question around, oh, I don't know how long it's going to take me, so I don't know how to price it. The underlying message is I price based on time. And that is the challenge. And when you price based on time, typically you price marginally in such a way, assuming that the customer wants to pay you by the hour for your work. In other words, Kathy, when the client comes to you and says, I need monthly bookkeeping services, and you take 5 minutes to assess their needs and say, okay, here's my price, $300 a month. In your mind, I assume that you charge $50 a month and you did the calculation of how many hours it was going to be. And you said, okay, so 6 hours, you know, $500, whatever the amount is. And then you price it based on that number. And then when the month that it goes over, all of a sudden your business model didn't work. But the problem was that you priced marginally based on the hours that you thought it was going to take you. So the answer that Kirk gave you is actually, I would call it a level one answer. It's an answer that it's designed for someone that hasn't evolved to think beyond time would need to hear, which is price it high enough so that if it does take you 20 hours, it makes up for it. And then some months will fluctuate up and down. But I want to take it one step further, and I think Kirk's answer was fantastic, but I think the best way to connect to a fellow bookkeeper or accountant and say is, if you forget about how long it takes you as the way you price it, right? And then you price it high enough that it is worth your while, whether it takes you 5 hours, 10 hours, or 50 hours to do the work, then you will be happy no matter how long it takes. And how long it takes you to do something, which is typically data entry, bookkeeping, cleanup work, correct? So how long it takes you is not what the client cares about. The client only cares about, and on the same terms, how much less time they are going to invest doing the work. They care about the financial statement, the result, and the information that they can use to make decisions with less anxiety and feel that the everyday work that they do in their business is being supported by the numbers that are measuring the results of their work. So if it takes you 5 hours, 10 hours, or 15 hours, the customer honestly doesn't care. What the customer cares about is what they're going to do with the output of your work. And if you're able to discover what is it that they're going to do, as Kirk said, higher value services, what are they going to do with it? and you can satisfy them consistently on the months that it takes you little or in the months it takes you a lot, you will be profitable, you will be happy, and your client in turn will be happy. So Kirk, I just wanted to kind of translate it to like the day-to-day bookkeeping terms, because I feel frustrated as well when I budget, you know, for, you know, I have 60 hours that I work in a week, as I work a lot and I want to spend time with my family. So when I budget my 60 hours to work with clients and it ends up one or two can screw up my whole week and delay my delivery for my entire client base, I understand that frustration. But the frustration really comes from inside your head. The frustration comes with the realization that you were not, quote, profitable because it took you longer. And I think shifting that mindset, it's extremely liberating, and it really creates some clarity around pricing it based all client-centric. Kirk, what do you think about that? Was that right or no?
Well, it's interesting listening to you. I realized a couple of things. First of all, I gave a polite answer. And second,
now your answer was perfect, I think. Mine was the next year answer.
Well, and the other thing was, you know, for the next year session, we're going on the assumption that everybody understands that time is irrelevant. For the first session, I'll spend a little bit of time, you know, kind of debunking all these myths about hourly pricing initially, but I'm not going to spend a tremendous amount of time, because the people that I want to have in that session are the people who have kind of at least intellectually said yes to the fact that time is irrelevant and that customers don't care about how long it takes. They only care about the result, and they're ready to move forward. But realizing probably that I'm going to have some, not skeptics, but people that are still reluctant in the room, I'll tackle that a little bit. But the harsh reality is the time doesn't matter. And this is one of those things, when you say it, you're like, oh, it's easy for you to say, hard to do. But actually, once you start doing it, you'll find it's easy to do. Once you start ignoring time as something that's important, time becomes unimportant. Time tends to take care of itself when you're not focusing on it. When you start focusing on the results, you're focusing on what matters. Now, that's not to say that we don't do resource planning, or as my friend Ed Kless will call it, timesheets in advance. But the short answer is time becomes irrelevant. It's a mindset shift, and that's part of what we'll assume that the audience is ready to do, that intellectually they're there, or even it could be, what they're going to be one of two places. Either their head's there and their heart's not, or their heart's there and their head's not. But we're going to assume that getting one of those two is 50%, and it's enough to set a plan and a goal and move forward. Now, I do want to just mention the third session that I've gotten, and I want to come back and ask you some questions about your session. But the third session I'm doing, we're going to do a deep dive into what people have said is probably one of the two toughest skills that you need in order to implement value pricing, and that is the art of having a value conversation. And so I'm doing a session on the art of questions. And we're going to talk about not only what are the questions you ask, but how do you ask them? How do you start the conversation? How do you keep the conversation on track? How do you place clues and kind of guide the customer? How do you serve as a Sherpa? A Sherpa, for those who don't know, these are the natives in the Himalayas around Mount Everest who have lived there all their life and who help guide people from the Western world up to the top of Mount Everest. They serve as a guide or a Sherpa. And we're going to talk about how do you do that with your customer through this session called The Art of Questioning. We'll talk about questions you need to ask before you have the conversation, questions you need to ask during the conversation, questions to ask afterward. How do you come back and have a secondary conversation? We're going to talk about all of that. So that's my second session, and it's been kind of pulled out. And so there will be a little bit of overlap, but we're going to spend a whole, you know, you mentioned there 50 or 100-minute sessions. All three of these sessions right now are 100-minute sessions. And so we're going to be spending a full 2 hours essentially on this essential skill of how do you have the value conversation under the title, The Art of Question. So Hector, I'll give you a chance if you want to ask anything about that, but where I want to really get to is I want to ask you some questions about your video session. So anything on that third session before we swap chairs?
No.
So let's get back to your video session. So I know you've done video sessions in the past, and you know, you're kind of, you know, you're the video marketing YouTube guru in your space. One of, you know, two or three individuals who, when you mention this type of marketing, that, you know, your name immediately comes up. What have you learned over the past year that you're going to be sharing? In other words, how is this session going to be different from maybe what you did a year or 2 years ago? What have you learned since then that you're going to be bringing?
Okay. So the first thing I learned, and this is what I've learned from the get-go of getting into this video marketing business, and then what I've learned in the last year. So I'm going to split it into two. The first thing I've learned from the video marketing business is you have to either decide that creating videos, it's a labor of love and that's it. Or creating videos will be a for-profit activity. And the reason why the mindset is important is because the quality of your video tends to be a virtual wall in your head in terms of whether or not this is good enough to sell. So let me explain to you what I mean. When I first started doing this, in my mind was, I can't sell this. You know, this is very rough. It contains it contains errors. I'm not a perfect video editor. I don't have good lights. My microphone wasn't that good. So I already had decided in my head that this wasn't something that I was going to sell. Now, that was a great mindset, by the way, because the minute I convinced myself that I wasn't going to sell the videos, I was almost free and open to just create. And all that fear of making mistakes, all that fear of being judged, and all that fear of trying to sell something that's not high quality enough or getting refunds completely went away. So I went on a video creation rampage and posted them on YouTube, not for sale. They were just out there. And there was a huge, very important mind shift change that I had internally, which is, okay, so now that I'm spending less, and by the way, when I started this, I was still transforming my practice into value pricing. So back then, my mindset is I'm giving up billable time. That's why I can use that expression. Back then, it was something I used. I'm giving up billable time in order to create video. And how am I going to get that billable time back? Well, the answer is I cannot get the billable time back. But what I can get through the videos, especially if you do them right and you do it high quality, and you don't care about the profit motive, and you do it from the heart, and you create content that other people can connect with, what you do create is reputation. And you create a real solid foundation for reputation around what you know or your skills. Now, some people make skateboarding videos, right? And what they're trying to sell is, I guess, skateboarding skills. I don't do that. I do videos about accounting and tax and QuickBooks and how to fix errors and the problems that I run into with some of my customers. And I'm essentially giving away what I usually charge for. Like a lot of the stuff that I know, it's the secret sauce, it's the experience, it's the stuff that people pay for. But what ends up happening is when you start sharing stuff that nobody else does, when you share things without worrying that you're giving away too much, and therefore you're somehow going to lose a potential customer, you start attracting a different type of customer. You start attracting the customer that wasn't 100% dependent on you, the customer that tried to do it themselves, or they try to educate themselves before hiring someone else. And one of the most satisfactory things about working with clients I get from YouTube. It's when their email says, hey, I was watching this video on importing items and I spent 4 hours trying to import them and I run into these four situations. I try to follow your video, but my situation seemed to be very unique. I want to hire you for a couple hours or just to solve my problem. You know, and these emails have a really high conversion rate. When I call the client and I say, hey, thank you for watching my video, whatever. It sounds like this is something that we could schedule a morning for and take care of it. Here's my price. And most clients say, absolutely. I'm going to tell you why. One, because they tried it themselves, so they actually got a taste to how difficult or how valuable it is for someone to spend their livelihood and their life mastering a technical skill, right? So right off the bat, they're not fighting for, oh, this is only going to take you 4 hours, so you shouldn't charge me this, this, and that. They actually understand. They were submerged deep in what you do for a couple hours, and they said, you know what? I got to get an expert, right? Because I'm just going to waste way too much time doing this, or I'm going to get it wrong. So that's one. Two is they can go out and shop for an expert, and they can go talk to someone that says they can do it versus the one that demonstrated on the screen that they can do it. So think about what that does just in terms of comparative advantage. And the third thing is price. I mean, going back to your, when they come back and say, oh, that's very expensive. And my answer usually is, well, what are you comparing it to? It's like, well, I don't know. I'm sure somebody will do it for, and your customers even say this, $100 an hour. And I say, well, sure, not a problem. Just, you know, before you hire them, make sure you watch their video so to know that that's what they know what to do. And they usually say, well, I can't find their video. And I say, exactly. And I drop my mic and hang up the phone and wait for them to call me back. Well, I really don't do that, but that's what I feel like doing. Because, you know, once you build that reputation that you have the library, that you have the database, that you've shown people how to do it, and, you know, people are just going to gravitate towards wanting to buy something from you. So I would say that was the existential, most important lesson that I got from the benefit of exchanging quote unquote billable time to building a library of video educational video content that's going to create a reputation, the type of reputation that brings really high quality clients. Now, let's fast forward. Oh, you want to say something, Kirk?
I was just going to draw two points from your comments that stood out to me. Number one is the fact that once you get over the fear of how do I look and are my lights right and all that kind of stuff, because when we started this, those were things that I worried about. Now I'm like, whatever. I'm not whatever, but I realize it's good enough, right? There is a point for good enough, and then you can get better later. But having a medium where it forces you to verbalize or write out your thoughts on certain things actually helps you develop your thought leadership. It actually helps you to develop stronger opinions, stronger viewpoints, and articulate them in ways that you might not otherwise. I articulate things very differently from having done this show with you than I did prior to it on certain topics. The second thing is it draws a different kind of customer. And that ties in with the sessions I'm doing, which is the fact that, you know, if you're worried about how do I get customers, you know, to switch over, well, one way is to try to convert existing customers. The other is attract a different kind of customer, and the type of customer you're attracting through your videos are the ones that are more interested in what's your price to solve my problem, not how many hours will it take. What else would you add about your session?
Well, I would say absolutely bingo. The other piece that I've learned, I would say more recent, is that you can sell these things. You actually can sell educational content. There's a lot of folks, and this is, I would say the expression that people use is selling information, okay? There's a lot of folks out there selling information, and a lot of it is great, and a lot of it is bogus, right? What is the traditional way that people sell information? Kirk, what is the most traditional way that someone sells information? Maybe we're in the same wavelength here.
I'd say probably books.
That's it, right? This is how people sell information, right? And traditionally has been the best conduit to sell information. You write a book, charge $20 for it, whatever. Now, some are not really great at writing. I'm one of them. I'm horrible at writing, and I don't have the discipline. I don't. But I'm actually pretty good at sitting in front of a computer and talking about something that I'm passionate about. And I guarantee you that 99% of the population is like that. You learn skills around, you know, using video editing software, about getting your camera, your microphone. You learn those skills. Those are really simple soft skills. Nobody's born knowing how to use a camera or doing video editing. Anybody can learn that. Okay. You know, whereas maybe being a writer, an editor, you know, it could be a gift, I would say, just because writing has a lot of rules and it has to be done right, and because you lose your audience. Video it's very open and free form, and it's also very natural. So I would say that's an important piece. So for the folks that don't know how to write books or can't write a book or don't find writing books exciting enough, video is one of the easiest conduits. And then once you have content that people want, even if you do if you tease, right? Like if you do what I call value added teasing, which is what my YouTube channel is. My entire YouTube channel is a huge value added tease. Like tons of people, I would venture to say thousands, if not millions, because it's got over 3 million views, have gotten value from me without spending a dollar. Okay. And that's just all value added teasing. And I would say, let's assume that that's 50,000 people. I'm never going to get paid from them. And I've only gotten paid from maybe 100. But those 100 have actually subsidized everybody else. Because the ones that like what you do, and then you promise to give them more, deep dive, one-on-one, you know, answering emails, you know, value-added services, a private session, private Zoom-based seminar. When you combine your educational videos that you give out for free with some premium content or some content plus some one-on-one, people will absolutely pay for that. And your YouTube channel or whatever video platform you use will become the credibility. I mean, most authors, you know, you can't, you know, they don't go around life not saying that they're authors. Like that is them. That's who they are. That's what they represent. You know, what they've written is their livelihood. So, and authors get invited to shows and the TV shows and radio shows and podcasts because of the book that they wrote. Okay. You know, so that's a really important point. So the folks that just are not good at writing like me, YouTube has been the way for me to write books, and this is how I write, and this will be the legacy, I think. You know, as long as my YouTube channel is open, I think the information that I transferred from me learning it to YouTube has been the videos that I created. So that has been sort of what I've learned, is that you can sell this stuff, and I've been selling some of this stuff. And I also have another session. Kirk, you want to talk about the inventory session?
Yep. Yeah. Let's hear about it.
Okay. So going back to the I'm just going to make a quick comment. You had one of the answers was that time was not important. And I would say that for pricing, time is not important. But for a practitioner, a bookkeeper, an accountant, the time it takes you to do something inside of a software, it's important if there's an opportunity to do it better or faster. So that's a really important point I wanted to make. And inventory, it's one of those really big, heavy tasks for anyone. You know, there's a lot of attention to details. You have to create the inventory part. You have to receive the inventory. You have to adjust the inventory if the quantity on hand doesn't include the reality. You have to reserve the inventory for someone that's you know, committing to buy it, but you're not delivering it yet. You have to ship the inventory. You have to account for the sale and the cost of goods sold and the accumulated value of your inventory in stock. That entire workflow is very exhausting for folks in the QuickBooks world. So what my session is designed around doing is to give you a Reader's Digest version of what all the versions of QuickBooks do in terms of inventory, what the restrictions are. I spend a lot of time talking about what it does, and I spend even more time talking about what it doesn't do. It's funny, you know, I could spend, you know, the 200 minutes talking about, you know, what you click here, click there, and then on my last slide that says what QuickBooks doesn't do, which is like 15 things that it doesn't do, people say this is the best slide. Because when you tell people what it doesn't do, that means I already tried doing it and I already went through the pain point of telling the client, sure, I'm sure we can figure out how to do it. And at the end, I'm telling you, it doesn't do it. Like, don't even bother. So when you know what the restrictions and the limitations of a system is, you, from the get-go, you design your process around knowing what those limitations are. And I think that knowing those limitations upfront, instead of bumping into them and having to start over or re-engineer, are the most valuable. So I try to concentrate a lot around, you know, pushing the boundaries to doing all the way to what QuickBooks can do, but making it very clear about all the deficiencies and shortfalls that it has. So that's what my advanced inventory class is all about. And it talks about QuickBooks Desktop, not QuickBooks Online. I don't want to get into the weeds of it, but it's just a much more powerful software when it comes to inventory.
Well, I think even Intuit would admit that they're still developing, enhancing, improving the online product. And there are certain things that the desktop version, especially enterprise, can do that are not in online. And they would admit that readily. And so it's interesting. I want to tie your two sessions together. I don't know if you've thought about this, but that last slide, that's probably the information you can sell.
Yeah, that's true.
And I bet that slide is longer this year than it was last year, and probably next year it's going to be two slides, and so on and so forth. It's interesting, you know, when you first said inventory, my first thought was, oh my goodness, he's going to put me to sleep. You know, and I've dealt with inventory as a software developer, but yet there are people who need, because inventory is kind of, for most of us, one of those sleeper topics, there are business owners and entrepreneurs who need people who know how to handle it, who know how to track it, who know how to do it well. And so for your market, this session is gold.
I would even venture to say that if you are a business advisor or a business consultant that does nothing around accounting and nothing around inventory, but the client that you're consulting with, the customer you're consulting with, it's an inventory-based business. Understanding the pain points around inventory workflow, which is the heart of any business that sells product, is going to give you so much insight around how to make their operation better. Like it is, once you, especially manufacturing, like even if you don't know anything about manufacturing and plan to do no consulting work around the manufacturing engineering process, but if you understand what makes it difficult, where the pain point is, where people are spending the most time and energy around, where the errors come from, you know, where the efficiencies and effectiveness come from, it allows you to step back as an observant and really suggest naive things like, you know, why is that machine there instead of being there? Doesn't it seem easier instead of walking back and forth? Something that has nothing to do with accounting, but when you observe it from a very, when you do very naive observation of an inventory product processing, manufacturing process, and you look at things, there are so many things that are more obvious to a naive, non-accounting person than someone that's only looking at cost of goods sold and inventory asset and debits and credits and stuff like that. So I find that to be one of the really enjoyable pieces of doing inventory-based consulting work, which is just observing how people work with their product and maneuver their product on top of also looking at the accounting piece.
Well, you did a pretty good job of selling what I, you know, teasingly called a boring topic. So I'm going to have to check and see if I will be able to drop in for part of that session. And you're right. You're exactly right. I was baiting you on that.
All right, Kirk. All right. So I think that's good. Do you have any parting words?
Well, I'll just say we would love to hear if you're going to be at Scaling New Heights. If you're going to be there, feel free to drop us a comment below the video or post a comment in our Facebook group for Art of Advisory. Let us know you're there. Hecker and I we'll probably have a hangout time organized, some type of meetup where we'd love to hang out and get to know those of you that are with us each week or on a semi-regular basis. So if you're going to Scaling New Heights, be sure and give us a heads up.
Yeah, and check it out if you're more interested in hearing about the conference. It's www.scalingnewheights.com, and it's June 17th to the 20th. Kirk, I'll see you next week.
See you, Hector.